Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we love to talk about teaching multilingual learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferron Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the ENL team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Hello and welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Our Burning Questions for today are, what are the most notable challenges over the past year with regard to equitably teaching ELLs? And moving forward, what considerations should teachers and administrators be mindful of when thinking about returning to in-person learning with English language learners? So here to discuss these Our Burning Questions with us today are my special guests, Megan Gregoire-Smith and Mindy Teach. Megan and Mindy, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
Great. So before we get started, I just would like to have you just introduce yourselves a little bit. So if you could just share your title and your role, your special areas of interest, and what drew you to working with ELLs. Megan, would you like to go first?
Sure. So my name is Megan Gregoire-Smith. I am an English learner coach with Support Ed, and so in that role, I facilitate a lot of professional development around best practices for English language learners. I do some coaching with teachers and curriculum support. So what got me into working with English learners was, for my undergraduate degree, I studied international relations, and I knew that I was really interested in languages and cultures. So when I decided to go and get my master's, I then discovered TESOL. Mm-hmm. And during my time earning my master's degree, I taught English as a foreign language in Guayaquil, Ecuador, and then came back to the States and started teaching elementary ESOL. Mm-hmm. In the state of Maryland, and just fell in love with the position. And ever since then, have been working in the field and have moved from being an English teacher to being a coach for teachers of English language learners.
Awesome, thank you.
I am also an English learner coach for Support Ed, so my job responsibilities are very similar to what Megan described, providing professional development. I've done some coaching with teachers, which has been very interesting this year in the virtual environment. Mm-hmm. I also got interested in working with language learners pretty early on in my undergraduate career, where I was doing some tutoring with some kids, so I became interested in education. Mm-hmm. And then just my own personal travel, just like being in other countries and just experiencing that feeling of not understanding what's going on around you when other people are speaking in a different language just really made me think, you know, how important it is to really support people in understanding and being able to communicate in the language that's used in the country that they're in. So when I came back, I spent a year abroad after my undergraduate work, and when I came back to the United States, I pursued my master's in teaching ESL. And I did most of my teaching, I did all of my teaching in the District of Columbia Public Schools, and then also transitioned into more of a professional development role. I have a great interest in elementary education, particularly literacy for beginning English language learners, and have transitioned into more of a coaching and professional development role.
Great, thank you. Thank you so much. And welcome again. So, as you mentioned, this past year has been extremely challenging, right? We know, and I'm sure that you have lots of information to, and lots of experiences to share with us with this, you know, in terms of this experience. So in terms of socio-emotional support, what are some of your noticings from the field with regard to addressing social-emotional needs?
One thing that that I have noticed in some of the coaching that I've done with teachers is that teachers have taken what they know to be very good practices in their classrooms and done their very best to apply them even in the virtual environment. So teachers know that it's really important to build community, and they've done everything they can to build community. And I've seen some really amazing virtual communities within classrooms. So some ways that teachers have done this is, you know, when kids were still virtual, they were opening up their Zoom links early and kids could just come in and they could chat. I've noticed teachers that still greet students individually every single time they come onto a Zoom. So there's still that personal connection. And as the year went on and, you know, people were getting a little bit of Zoom fatigue and tired of doing all the virtual learning, teachers have changed up some of those strategies. I've seen teachers start doing that. What do you prefer? Which would you choose? So bringing in some games and activities that would get students a little bit more engaged and involved in conversation.
And I had the opportunity to visit a number of different virtual classrooms throughout this experience, K through 12. And I saw teachers, just like Mindy said, using a lot of really creative strategies to address students' social emotional needs. One thing I saw was teachers using soft openings with students, so showing them pictures or emojis and GIFs, and students using those to identify and describe how they're feeling. Mm-hmm. I also noticed that teachers were either opening their class a little early or they were staying on a little bit longer so students could have conversations after class. I noticed that some students would kind of hang out in the virtual classroom a little bit longer until everyone left so that they could have those conversations with teachers. Mm-hmm. And teachers were really taking the time to engage in those conversations. Mm-hmm. And then I knew a couple of teachers who did some really neat things with kind of after school virtual hangouts where they would have kind of a social event like a dance party or a game night virtually to kind of provide students with that socialization piece that was missing.
Awesome. So I don't want to focus on the negative, but what did you notice that didn't work?
Well, I think there was certainly a struggle for, at least initially, for students to become engaged in some of the lessons. One school district that I worked on the middle school level, and it was a constant conversation around, you know, how to really engage them. They didn't want to unmute, they didn't want to show their, they didn't want to turn their videos on.
Right.
So in some cases, interacting live on the session was challenging. Sometimes even getting students to sign on, attendance was certainly an issue. And then there was also some struggle with getting students to submit assignments. I would talk to teachers and they would say, you know, we just sat through, this is what we just did in the lesson. And I guess the student just didn't click the submit button. So just, you know, getting all of those things in order and getting students to turn in assignments was nice. Challenging.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. A lot of what I heard from teachers was just, especially in the beginning, really getting students to engage and actively participate in the lesson, getting them to unmute their microphone and actively participate took a lot of time for teachers to build that trust with students and to get routines in place in order to facilitate the level of engagement that's needed for language development.
Right. And I know that, you know, with the remote learning, I know the schedules probably were adapted to meet the needs, and so there was probably less time for instruction than there used to be when it was in person, and so now we're kind of moving into that hybrid. So you know, some students are, I know in my home district, you know, some of the students now they're focusing trying to get everybody back, but you still have a hybrid. So what are some considerations that have to be thought about moving forward as we think about like the next school year?
So moving forward, I would say, I think through this experience, we have seen a big focus on the importance of social emotional learning. So working to really maintain that focus on social emotional needs, I think is really important. We know that it's really critical to create that social emotional connection to our students in order to create a safe space to learn.
Right.
And that's true whether we're online, hybrid, face-to-face. So really maintaining that focus, I think, is going to be important. And one strategy for teachers to do that would be through the use of storytelling. So having students tell stories through interviews or personal narratives or artwork could be a helpful strategy.
It will be really interesting for teachers to talk to students about kind of what they've learned about themselves as learners over this past year. Some students have become very independent. Some students have really realized the places that they really need support. Mm-hmm. So I think that'll be a really interesting conversation to have at the beginning of the year.
Right, that advocacy piece is really important, right? And we want students to be able to advocate for themselves. So I guess that's a silver lining, right?
Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you know, we kind of talked about the instructional piece of it and what the challenges were. Let's talk a little bit about formative assessment, because you alluded to the fact that it was very hard to connect with students remotely. And so with that comes the challenge of trying to assess where they are in their learning, right? So what were your noticings with that regard in terms of assessment? And what makes this situation so unique?
The situation was so unique for teachers in figuring out how to assess students. In distance learning, teachers could not just peer over a student's shoulder to check in on them. You couldn't pull a student to the side in the moment to do a check for understanding. So like these informal opportunities for formative assessment kind of instantly disappeared when we moved into remote learning. So teachers had to kind of quickly adapt to this new learning environment and make adjustments to their practices. So I think that as teachers became more familiar with the technology platforms that they were using, they found some creative ways to do this, by assigning students different assignments, for example, in Google Classroom, having students turn their assignments in different ways, you know, taking a picture of something if they weren't able to type it up and things like that. But there were definitely challenges. I mean, teachers were not able to get back as much work as they typically would in a face-to-face setting. So teachers really had to adapt their practices, make use of their observations to make a lot of instructional decisions.
And I just want to give a shout out to all teachers, because I know that this was not easy. And you know, when you think about transitioning from 100% remote to a hybrid situation to fully in person, or whatever the combination may be, it's like having the first day of school all over again, right?
Right.
So
right.
I just wanted to put that out there and just you know put a shout out to all of the teachers out there that are hanging in there and doing what's right for the kids every day.
Right, so, absolutely.
Yeah. Mindy, did you have anything you wanted to add? I just wanted to interject that.
No, I think that's such an important interjection. Yeah. That point that not only did they have to make this transition and transition everything that they've been doing to virtual, but then there were also those intermediary transitions throughout the year where we, just kept shifting and shifting and shifting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree with you 100%. A huge thank you to all the teachers. Mm-hmm. But again, I feel like teachers were using their skills that they've been using even, before we got here, which
right.
includes being very flexible, thinking mm-hmm. on their feet, mm-hmm. very creative. Mm-hmm. So maybe an assignment that, initially was not going to be, graded, or they were going to use it one way, they shifted and began using it a different way. So I think there just had to be a lot of flexibility and creativity.
Yeah, that's a really good point. All right. So as we're talking about, transitioning back to in-person instruction in the fall, in terms of assessment, what advice would you give to a district who's looking for the preparedness of English language learners for in-person instruction?
Well, I think we want to certainly keep in mind all of those challenges that we've just mentioned. We know that we're not coming from a typical year. So even some of this data that we've collected, we just want to be careful about how much we take it to heart. We say every year as teachers, we ask the teacher before, what was this kid like? What can you tell me about this kid? And we always say, just be careful with that information. I feel like this is the same kind of situation. We can certainly look at those data points and they're valuable, mm-hmm. but those are not the only pieces of information that we want to be looking
right.
at. We want to give our students some time to be in the classroom and readjust to being in school and all those adjustments that it requires both in school and at home even.
Mm-hmm.
So just to take all of that into consideration, especially in the first few weeks of school.
I would just also add in that, you know, thinking about other skills that our students learned and acquired throughout this experience that is not going to be shown on a formal assessment that's given, right? So I'm thinking about some of our youngest learners, kindergartners, first graders, who, you know, had to learn to take care of their own technology, to navigate technology independently. These are skills that if we were face-to-face, they may not have learned this early on. So keeping in mind that, you know, there are other skills and other things students learned, and so maintaining that asset-based perspective, I think, is going to be really, really important for districts, teachers.
Yeah, and thinking about those skills and that underlying piece about, you know, social emotional learning, right? That's I think that it spirals through everything, right? We talked about it at the beginning, but you know that it spirals through all of this. So I know we don't want to place a lot of weight on data, but what are some ways that that districts can use data to differentiate instruction?
So I would start by evaluating domain and content-specific data points to kind of determine appropriate scaffolds for students to determine appropriate differentiation. And then once teachers have really put some of these scaffolds into place, being sure to take time to reevaluate, are these working for my students? Do I need to make adjustments to what I've done, to my grouping? And I think it's also important to keep in mind that we should incorporate student voice into this when we're differentiating. So thinking about what students know is helpful to them and asking students. So I found that when we ask students to kind of share what works for them in the classroom as a support, they're able to give us a lot of information. I know a lot of teachers who provide kind of checklists at the beginning of the year where students are identifying, you know, it's really helpful for me when the teacher provides me with visuals or when the teacher incorporates group work. So getting to know students and incorporating those supports that they tell us work for them as well.
I was just going to say, I would certainly highlight that student data. I mean, that's data too that we collect from our students. And again, we would also want to bring in our families. We could survey families and talk to them about, you know, things that they've noticed over the past year or goals that they have for the year ahead for their student. And, you know, those are also valuable pieces of data.
Yes, thank you. So Megan, you talked about domain-specific data. So what specific data-related criteria could be used for instruction and placement?
So I'm thinking about language proficiency data can be helpful in making instructional decisions, but I also know that because of what happened the last year, we're not necessarily going to have up-to-date formal assessments necessarily for all of our students to give us that language proficiency data. So I think that what we're going to have to do is really rely on information from our ENL teachers. What did they observe about students' language growth throughout this school year? Do they have rubrics that they've used throughout the year to kind of capture that growth? And use that to really inform our instruction if we don't have that more formal English language proficiency data.
I mean, just to build on that, I think that what Megan is saying about, you know, the student information, like if we have evidence, if we have student work, if we have those actual pieces of work, and maybe we need to dive a little bit more into doing some analysis of different types of student work, that would bring us more information as well.
We know that in terms of supporting our English language learners, right, we know that some of that data, that student data that you talked about, is important to know. Also, you know, the assessment data as well to assess their proficiency. And we use that data to help figure out how to scaffold for English language learners. So what are some of the misconceptions about the provision of instructional scaffolds and scaffolded materials for English learners that you share?
The number one misconception is that scaffolds make something easier for the students. That is just, it makes the assignment easier. I feel like I've been confronting that since I've been teaching or been in the field. Also this idea that scaffolds are not fair, that it doesn't you know, that it gives them an unequal advantage, which is actually the exact opposite of what scaffolds are intended to do. We're working to make sure that everybody has access to this material.
Right.
I also think there's a misconception that these scaffolds are going to stay in place forever. And that's part of, you know, where we talk about why it is fair for these students, because this is what they need right now. But as they get stronger or they develop different skills, we're going to strategically remove some of these scaffolds or put a different type of scaffold in place.
Right.
So that kind of leads into the other misconception, is that, you know, there's just this blanket way that we scaffold all of our materials and all of our assignments for all of our English language learners.
A misconception that I see, and Mindy kind of touched on this, is that all Ls would require the same scaffold simply for being a language learner,
right.
And that it would be the same scaffold for every content area. But really, what we know is that individual students are going to need different scaffolds depending on the activity, the domain that they're working in, as well as the subject area. So if students have a lot of background knowledge on a certain topic, they might require different scaffolds than if they're working in a topic that's completely new to them. So really that individualization of the scaffolds.
And that took some additional work on the part of the teacher and on the part of the students to really make sure that everybody understood their role and they were clear on the assignment and, you know, the expectations and all those pieces. So there definitely were some shifts.
Yeah. So what challenges do you foresee for Ls in the transition to in-person learning with regard to grouping?
I definitely think there's going to be some adjustments that are going to have to be made, right? So teachers have spent a lot of time working on these routines to get group work to work in a virtual or a hybrid environment, right? And so now as we move back to more fully in person, they're going to have to adjust those routines once again and kind of reteach students those routines. And one thing that I've been thinking about is some things that I've seen, which have been nice for some students, right, is that use of the chat. So they were able in their group work virtually to rely on the chat rather than unmuting and using their voice to explain their ideas. So I think it's going to be important for teachers to think about that and the individual students' needs, and maybe finding ways in group work to ease students back into those full, heavy conversations. So I was thinking about activities that could be done where students are doing maybe some shared writing before engaging in discussion, things like using a chalk talk or a graffiti board where students are all jotting down their ideas before engaging in a discussion.
Right. Yeah, I was also thinking about the role of technology, what the role of technology is going to be.
I was just thinking along the same lines that Megan was talking about the chat. Like, that was always sort of like a backup option. You know, teachers, even in the student groups, would say, you know, if you don't want to unmute, then go ahead and type it into the chat.
Right.
So, you know, as Megan was saying, we really are going to need to think creatively around options, like making some of those options available to students. One thing that I do remember working with a group of teachers on before, when we were in person, was teaching students gestures. So maybe starting with some students, they can start with gestures if they want to add on to what somebody's saying, or if they made a connection to what somebody's saying. So maybe that could be a starting point for some students.
Yeah. So we've been talking about, you know, teachers in relation to students and their instruction and supporting the students. But let's kind of shift our focus a little bit to collaboration and co-teaching, right? Because we know that, you know, with ENL teachers, sometimes they're not dually certified and they have to collaborate with content area teachers. So, and we know sometimes this is a challenge, right? So why do you think that there's often a breakdown in terms of the collaboration between ENL teachers and content teachers?
Well, I think one of the reasons for that is just a lack of understanding or a lack of recognition of the expertise of the other professional. So I think, you know, some of those professional conversations need to happen, and we don't always make the time or space for some of those conversations to happen, just so that, you know, teachers can share about themselves, their experiences, their expertise, their teaching style. In my experience, oftentimes it's the ENL teacher who's walking into the physical classroom of another teacher. So in a way, that's almost like already a barrier, is that I'm going into somebody else's space. So that can be challenging for the collaboration.
Another breakdown that might happen sometimes is that clear definition of roles, right? Mm-hmm. If co-teaching teams don't take time to really plan out those structures, who's in charge of which piece of the lesson, what is my role within the lesson for this day or within the unit, there can be a breakdown there. And so building those relationships and taking time for co-planning, I think, is really key.
And, you know, anytime I think of co-teaching, I always think of Drs. Honigfeld and Dove and
yes.
all of the work that they've done with co-teaching. So those are great resources.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Mindy, you had mentioned, you know, leveraging expertise. So how can ENL teachers do that? How can they leverage their expertise when they're collaborating with other teachers?
Well, I think that, you know, in addition to the, hopefully that they would have some time to do some co-planning with their co-teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really encourage them during those co-planning sessions or even in conversation with those teachers to really feel empowered to share concrete suggestions,
mm-hmm.
concrete experiences,
mm-hmm.
and then also be willing, once they are back in the classroom together, to be modeling some of those suggestions that they're making.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked a lot with co-teachers, and oftentimes the ENL teacher is kind of always seeking permission of mm-hmm. the classroom teacher to do something. And I really work with teachers to encourage them to really recognize their own expertise and be willing to share their own expertise. I feel like in some ways we really need to encourage these teachers to get out there and be willing to be in front of the entire class, maybe,
right.
not only just their language learners,
yeah.
and to really be providing some support during certain parts of the lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think Mindy said it really well, just
okay.
Really being a partner in the classroom and a partner in planning is really important.
Yeah. What would you say, and this is, I'm just kind of, what would you say to, you know, what would you say to a teaching pair that might, where the content area teacher is a little reluctant or hesitant to welcome the ENL teacher into the classroom? What are some things that you've done, like with your, you know, with working with teachers?
Well, I can share a little bit about, I've certainly been in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes as the sort of neutral third party
mm-hmm.
and the coach, I could do a little bit of encouraging, like
mm-hmm.
really sit with teachers and sit with a lesson
yeah.
and just, you know, making those gentle suggestions. This would be a good place for the ENL teacher to such and such. And when we're sitting there together and co-planning with a little bit of encouragement, that can be really effective. I think another piece that's really interesting is that sometimes as ENL professionals, we don't realize that our general education partners don't always have all the information about the students that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when a teacher can come in and share some of this information,
right.
that makes the other teacher feel a little bit more comfortable. Like, wow, she really understands,
mm-hmm.
you know, where these students are and maybe what they need. And that can sort of bring them along as well to help
mm-hmm.
to have the ENL teacher be a little bit more involved.
Megan, did you want to add anything?
I think as part of those conversations, just making sure that the ENL teacher and the content area teacher kind of recognize each other's expertise, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like Mindy said, the ENL teacher might be bringing some language proficiency data and suggestions there, but then in turn, the ENL teacher being open to learning about the content, right? Because sometimes the ENL teacher comes in and has lots of language strategies, but might not know the content
right.
as well. So really, kind of building that relationship and understanding that you're both bringing things to the table that are going to benefit the students, and in the end you're working for those students, right?
Yeah.
And so you're all working towards the same goal.
And I think you bring up an important point about the ENL teacher learning the content, and I think it's important to bring to light the fact that ENL teachers are often in several different classrooms, several different content areas, several
right.
different buildings, right? And so they're having to learn all of this content. So I just wanted to point that out, just put that out there, just so that, you know, so that our listeners and our viewers know that
right.
for perspective, right?
Yes,
right?
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So And thinking about you know, co-planning, co-teaching, and collaboration, do you feel like it looks different now as opposed to before COVID? And if so, how?
I absolutely do. I think this part is a silver lining of mm-hmm. this whole thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the use of a virtual meeting, kind of the normalizing of using shared documents. Yeah. So, you know, before everything happened with the pandemic, I knew a few schools that, you know, use shared collaborative documents to mm-hmm. lesson plan and to add in scaffolds, but they were the outlier, right? That was yeah. a innovative idea. Mm-hmm. And now it's so normalized, everybody uses these shared documents. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really great opportunity for co-planning. So I'm just really hopeful that these are things that schools and teachers continue to use and continue to leverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree 100%. I feel like the stumbling block for co-teaching or collaborating was always, well, we don't have the same planning period. Yeah. And I feel like we've moved past that now. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, as we move on, we will see more collaboration happening. Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely. So you mentioned, you know, the like the Google Meets and web meetings and things like that, and shared documents. Are there any other co-planning tools that you might suggest and how they might be used to foster that collaboration?
Well, the one thing that I can think of is just like a shared, even if it's a shared lesson planning template, mm-hmm. you know, just so we're all working from the same mm-hmm. piece, you know, mm-hmm. and filling in the same pieces. And I think that also helps when teachers are starting to think about their own roles, like which parts am I doing, which parts are you doing, and you know, you can between the two of you decide how extensive you're going to be mm-hmm. in that lesson plan. Are we going to be, you know, deciding exactly what type of co-teaching model we're using? Are we going to discuss that later? So I think that can be really helpful.
I absolutely agree, and I'm just thinking about, this isn't a different tool, but just thinking about how we use it. Mm-hmm. When we're using the virtual meetings, if you're creating that co-teaching relationship, co-planning relationship, taking time in the beginning to develop norms and expectations, right, mm-hmm. For how that planning will look, and then if you know, creating a template that you're using so that it's really clear what everyone's role is. So I think just really thinking through how to use shared documents and virtual meetings to be as productive and efficient as possible.
And I'm just thinking that, you know, the common thread in all of this is communication, right? It's
yes.
communication. And I think, you know, these tools are really helpful in doing that. ...that are teaching in multiple buildings. They are often, I know when I was teaching, I worked in, you know, four different buildings. I worked in elementary, I worked in middle school and high school in the same district. And they were all different schedules. So, you know, I know that there are listeners and viewers out there that are probably thinking, I don't have time for co-planning. I don't have time. So what would you say to those teachers?
I think that for those teachers that work in multiple buildings, that mm-hmm. really this has opened up some different opportunities and different ways for mm-hmm. them to engage in co-planning. Yeah. You know, I was also an itinerant teacher. I worked in multiple schools, and mm-hmm. a lot of my time sometimes was spent driving from building to building.
Yeah.
And now, you know, if I imagine that same position now, I think I would, you know, find ways to leverage the time that I have virtually and create right. virtual meetings so that instead of spending that 40 minutes driving, I can
yeah.
spend it co-planning.
Right.
And then I actually saw some teachers do some really neat things with this, and it's not co-planning, but it's really leveraging these virtual tools.
Mm-hmm.
In like using a hybrid model, if you have students in multiple schools, so maybe you don't get to see them as often as you'd like, right? Because
right.
you have to travel from school to school.
Right.
So there's, I think, a possible opportunity here to continue to use a hybrid model where
mm-hmm.
you see some students in person, but then maybe they're also part of a virtual group on some days to continue that learning.
So I wanted to kind of shift along to families and advocacy, right? Because we know that in order for students, any students, not just ALS, but all students, in order for them to be successful, you know, they have to have support from the family, from their family, right? From the community. So what trends or challenges have you noticed over the past year with regard to families and advocacy?
first of all, alongside the great appreciation that we show for teachers, I think we really need to give a shout out to a lot of our families who have become educators
yes.
in our households as
yes.
well,
yes.
Or figured out how to at least be supportive for their students.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, again, teachers have always looked at families as being as our partners in education.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think they've tried and worked really hard this year to continue to do that and find the appropriate avenues to continue to do that.
Yeah.
The way teachers have picked up on, particularly for our language learners, the talking points and different apps that they can use to communicate with families,
right.
You know, surveys that have gone out to families to try and find out what is the best way for us to communicate with you.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the old days when I was in school, we thought the robocall was the greatest thing in the world. And now we're finding, you know, our families don't really even pick up voicemail messages, but they'll respond to text messages. So
yeah.
really continuing to stay in touch with the families and working with them to figure out what really works best for them. I think if and as we're transitioning to more in person, I think we need to keep in mind that there will probably also be some shifts for families. The accommodations
mm-hmm.
that they made this year
yeah.
to be there for their students,
mm-hmm.
you know, they might be shifting again next year as students go back into school. So we want to keep that in mind.
Good point. Very good point.
That's such a good point.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about how, you know, we saw a lot of challenges with this, but I saw teachers in schools finding lots of, you know, creative ways to quickly adapt to the needs that they saw, right? So
yeah.
we saw things that worked, like phone calls,
mm-hmm.
text messages, and things that didn't, and they adjusted. And so just like Mindy was saying,
mm-hmm.
kind of maintaining that flexibility and that two-way communication, so you
mm-hmm.
can get a sense as we move back into in-person, what is going to work for the families in my community.
Right. So, yeah, along those lines, what can teachers or districts do to determine those needs of the families, and how can we advocate for those needs?
I think using, you know, a family questionnaire at the beginning of the school year, you know, in families' preferred language, it
yeah.
could be a written questionnaire, it could be an oral questionnaire, it just depends on what is going to work for your families. And then having schools really take the time to analyze those and plan accordingly so that they can overcome any barriers that might exist.
Yeah.
And I think also just as much as possible as we're able to come back in person together more and more, having teachers and leaders in buildings get out into communities and spend time at community events and get to know families outside of school to build those trusting relationships is an important piece.
Thank you.
I think along those lines of getting back to more of in person is also making sure that parents are really aware of like who their contact people are within the school. Are there
yeah.
staff members who speak their language and making sure that they have, you know, direct contact with those people and feel comfortable contacting them about anything that they have questions about.
Right. Thank you. So in terms of advocating for ELLs and families, actually this is more related to like scheduling. What criteria do teachers and districts need to consider in terms of scheduling their ELLs and providing those specific supports that they need?
I think that when teams come together to make student schedules,
mm-hmm.
looking at multiple data points
yeah.
is always important, right? And even if we have some data points that might be missing, like we talked about earlier with some of the language proficiency data,
yeah.
pulling in sample assignments that students did to help
mm-hmm.
get a big picture of how
yeah.
they're doing.
Yeah.
And then also involve students and families. Maybe have students do some kind of self-reflection, self-assessment, so that they can provide some input about what they believe they need and what their goals are for their education.
I was just going to pick up on that goal setting, which is what we talked
yeah.
about a little bit earlier, is
yeah.
making sure that the families are involved and really
mm-hmm.
thinking about, you know, what are their hopes for their student in terms of their education.
Mm-hmm.
So making sure that they have access to what they need for that.
So in thinking about, you know, the past year and supporting English language learners, how has the support changed in terms of, you know, just in terms of, you know, the the educational support, the families, working with families, advocating for ELLs, how has all that changed over the past year, would you say?
I think that there's an increased awareness of the type of support that's needed. Mm-hmm. I think I have seen teachers think really carefully and strategically about specific students. So really using the information that they do have, really making use of what they do have, and thinking about each of those students and the different types of activities that they're planning and what that might mean. So I just think overall there's just been so much very careful and strategic thought.
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
Yeah, I'd have to agree, just an awareness of the need, and then also an awareness of the need for that family support and making families partners in education had became very, very clear through this pandemic.
Yeah, it definitely brought to light a lot of inequity, right, and just the things that we really didn't pay attention to that students really need, but it's really brought to the surface over the past year, right?
Right.
And it's been an experience for sure, right?
Oh yeah.
Yep.
for everybody, I know. And you know, I just want to shout out to the students for getting through this school year. Shout out to the teachers. Shout out to the families for, for supporting their, their children through all of this. And so, thinking about our next steps. So to our listeners and our viewers that are thinking, what are the first steps that we need to take in thinking about planning for next year? I know that Support Ed has created a checklist for, returning from returning to in-person learning. So it's a great resource that we will share with, once we share the recordings. What are the first steps and the next steps that teachers and districts need to consider moving forward?
I think one of the things that we definitely want to keep in mind is the social emotional piece. And we want to make sure that we're thinking about students' social emotional needs throughout the day and throughout their experience. We need to remember, even for students who are returning now in hybrid situations, I think we need to sort of eliminate this idea that we're just returning to normal and that everybody's going to come back into school and it's going to be like it was. Mm. So I think we want to sort of shift away from that and really recognize that in the beginning of the year, we really need to take the time to get to know our students. We need to figure out where they are, what they're bringing, and how we can build on from what they're bringing. Mm-hmm. I think we need to think about if we want to be making any shifts to any of our grading practices that we might have been implementing in the mm-hmm. past that might need a little thinking or tweaking. We want to consider that we want to be working, we want to be giving students some choices as they're coming back. We talked a little bit about the different choices that students had mm-hmm. in the virtual environment. Mm-hmm. And just also consider that we did have students who still to this day and up until the end of the school year were learning maybe virtually exclusively or maybe spending a lot of time doing work asynchronously, so very independent. So that's going to take some time to readjust them back to being in a classroom experience, maybe working a little bit more on timelines and that kind of thing. So,
thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.